Good evening, everyone. My name is Steve Sanderson. I'm president of the Wildlife Conservation Society, and I want to welcome you this evening to the Fairfield Osborne Memorial Lecture. I want to thank you first for coming out on this very pleasant evening where the temptations of the city are many. And we've had a very productive day for those of you who have just joined us this evening. We've had, from my perspective, a first-rate meeting and some good scientific papers and discussion and argument about the future of the world under a concept of health that unifies wildlife, human health, and domestic animal populations at a global scale. Tonight, before I get into the introduction, I want to remind you that we have a printed set of Manhattan Principles, which are available to you if you don't already have them. They should be outside the room. Yeah, so if you'd like to pick them up as you leave. These are a set of principles that were devised by the conference organizers in cooperation with the participants to try and make a set of statements that would move us forward and try to integrate these great concerns of human health and wildlife conservation and domestic animal husbandry and human well-being, and to try to integrate those activities across agencies and across enterprises and across the globe at a time when much of our attention is driven by crisis and crisis response. And that's no small feat. I think the principles are strong ones, and I hope that we as a group today agreed that we will try to push them forward in the coming months and years. So I invite you to get a copy and to give comments on them, and if you'd like to give those comments to Bob Cook, who is the organizer of the conference, and he deserves that. So anyway, I want to congratulate the conference organizers and the participants for a very invigorating day. It's my privilege and to some extent burden to introduce Bill Fagy to you. The privilege is clear. The burden is that, what can I say? His professional record is well known and is summarized in far too short a fashion in the program for the evening, and I don't want to rehearse that because it is nothing that I could say better than it's said in print. But I do want to say that his is a record of great distinction. He is not one among many, but he has stood out over a long and varied and rich professional career, and more importantly, a life that is devoted to public service. He has a tremendous wealth of experience, which makes him a perfect speaker for this great global challenge that we face. And importantly, and counterculturally, he represents in our world an ethic of selflessness and the diminution of the individual ego in favor of the social good. I wish I knew him much better, because everything I have seen him say or do or write or act on has been in the service of something larger than himself and not with an intention to draw attention to himself. And we live in the United States, if you'll forgive the editorial, in a culture that values individual entrepreneurship and leadership perhaps above its station. And Bill Fagy is a great example of the opposite, in which the will and the power of the individual is subordinated to something greater in the service of society, which is a wonderful attribute of his. He's also known because he has come to the defense of the defenseless. And he has spoken for children and their right to survive and our obligation as societies to ensure that they have the conditions to thrive. And he stood on behalf of eradicating infectious diseases that have crippled and maimed and killed the most defenseless and vulnerable populations in the world. And he's gone all over the world to speak to that commitment and act on it. And I am reminded of people, these very admirable people, many attorneys, public health officers, and ministers, and other service folks who have gone to the aid of status prisoners That is, who've come to the defense of people who are incarcerated around the world for no other reason than they're vagrants on the street, or they don't have an address, or they don't have money, or they are loitering because they don't have a place to go. And they're thrown into the jails, and they become prisoners of their social status, and no one will come to their defense. And there are a few people in this world, thankfully, that do come to their defense. And in the world of public health, Bill Foege defends the status prisoners of health. But he's no hair shirt. He is a pragmatic person who asks the question, who will help me get this done? With whom can I work, whether it's in the private sector or public agencies or the ministry or a university or a research institute? Who will help me get this done? Who will help us get this done? And it's reminiscent of the Little Red Hen, which is my favorite story. And you may know the story of the Little Red Hen. Little Red Hen was a very enterprising young hen. Well, I actually don't know her age, but she looked young to me. And she wanted to bake a cake. And she and the other animals that lived with her, the dog and the fox and the chicken and the cat, also thought a cake sounded good. And so she would say, "Well, who will help me harvest the wheat? And who will help me thrash it? And who will help me mill it?" And at each turn, her little fellow animals would say, "Well, not I." And they only came around when it was time to eat the cake. And to her great credit, the Little Red Hen didn't let them eat the cake at the end of the day, which was a bit spiteful, but I thought entirely warranted. If Bill Foege had been the Little Red Hen, all of those animals would have been pitching in. And the cake would have been baked, would have been a fine cake, and everybody would have had a bite. Bill?
Steve, thank you for that very embarrassing introduction, and I can tell you for sure it's the first time I've been compared to the Red Hen. But thank you especially for a very interesting day, a valuable day, because it was a day of bringing people with various perspectives together to understand that they have common challenges. And you've encouraged an unnatural act, which is for professionals of different persuasions to get together and talk. And I think always of C.P. Snow saying he assumed that we would never get the scientists and the humanities together. But we know it's hard even in science to get the various scientists together. And so you've done that today. And I would also like to thank the speakers today, not only for what they told us, but for unwittingly putting my speech together, because I kept thinking about this after the program and tried to incorporate what I was hearing. Part of the day was just great to reminisce. When we talked about Ebola virus, I thought back to when we sent the first teams to Congo and to Sudan, and then realize that's 25 years ago. That's a quarter of a century ago that happened. And that in turn made me think of my grandson, who last year I got a call from the preschool where he was a five-year-old student asking me if I would come pick him up because he was sick. And on the way home, I started asking him about his symptoms, and he explained, "It's the same thing I had when I was three." He said, "When I got sick at school today, it reminded me of the old times." But I found insights today and pearls of wisdom, memorable ideas, and all within the space of a few hours. And I thought how efficient this is, because sometimes I'll read an entire book and only get one sentence out of it that is worth keeping. And then that one sentence turns out to be worth having read the book. I was recently reading a book about the man who was mentally deranged who assassinated the Prime Minister of South Africa, in 68? And the book was not very interesting, but I finally got to the point of the assassination where he has a job as a page. And as the Prime Minister gets up to give a speech, he goes up and everyone thinks he's going to give him a note, and he pulls out a knife and kills the Prime Minister. And then the author says, at that moment, the power of madness met the madness of power. And that book was worth it for that one sentence. And so today, as we listened, I thought about a book I read years ago called Plague on Us. And the only sentence I remember out of that book is how much the people of science knew about the things they didn't understand. What a great commentary, I mean, because we kept getting information today but weren't quite sure what to do with it. Saturday night, this same grandson, who's now six, spent the night with us, and at the end of the day, I tell him a story, and I usually ask him, do you want a true story or do you want a made-up story, and he chooses. So Saturday night, when I finished, I said, let's turn this around, and you tell me a story. And he said, okay, do you want a true story or a make-believe story? And I said, let's have a true story. He thought about that for a moment, and he said, if it's a true story, it'll be very short. Could I add make-believe to it? So I said, sure. So he started out. I was in a boat and saw a barracuda. Then he said, the rest of this is make-believe. And I got thinking, as we were listening, we were hearing truth from the speakers today, but our fear was, will our follow-up, will our solutions be make-believe? It's easy for us to say the words, one world, one health. And it's easy to declare that healthy people require a healthy community, a healthy environment, conservation, a healthy economy, a healthy and secure world. That was, after all, the point that Polybius made 2,000 years ago. And I like to tell this story because I had given a talk where I used the phrase global village, and my son, who was a teenager at the time, but a history major, asked me afterwards, do you know who you were quoting when you said global village? And I said, of course, I was quoting Marshall McLuhan. And he just shook his head and he said, no, you were quoting Polybius. And then he got the quote for me, where Polybius says, it may have been possible in the past for things to have happened in isolation, but from this time forth, the world must be seen as an organic whole. 2,000 years ago. It's almost beyond our contemplation, but that's what the meeting was about all day today. And I was reminded of Barack Obama saying there is no black America or white America or Latino America or Asian America. There is only one America. And he said there are no blue states or red states that tell the story. And so today what we heard, we cannot tell the story by talking about viruses or bacteria or parasites or microorganisms in general, or people or animals or vectors. You cannot tell the story without including everything. You can't tell the story of human health divorced from animal health or environmental health. The world must be seen as an organic whole. 40 years ago, a Nigerian by the name of Yemi Ademola, who was a classmate of mine, wrote in our yearbook as we got our degrees in public health, quotes, there is no area of knowledge beyond the interest of public health professionals. He was killed a few years after that, and I repeat this as often as I can because part of his immortality comes from repeating those words, and those words re-echoed today. There's no area of knowledge beyond the interest of public health professionals. But are we serious? We may be interested, but are we serious? We always say we're worried about unforeseen consequences of our actions. But the truth is, as a society, we don't even seem to be worried about the foreseen consequences of our actions. Do no harm is said all the time in medical school. And yet, far more harm is done by errors of omission than what they're talking about in medical school, errors of commission. The knowledge not used, the vaccines not given, the water supplies not made pure, the nutrition not provided, the science not applied. And so this meeting today suggested that we become serious about the consequences of both our actions and our inactions. Some things stood out for me today. One, there are varying reasons why people were interested enough to spend the day. One is just the pure joy and beauty of nature, and that would be enough. In public health, we used to talk about prevention. Health prevention, and then finally we got to health promotion. And people kept asking, but what's the difference? And it's hard to define the difference except that disease prevention may leave you without diseases, but it may not give you the full potential of life. And it's that feeling you get at 6 a.m. when you're going to play racquetball with someone and you're looking forward to this. It's the feeling you get as you're about to spend a day with your grandchild. It's the difference between prevention and promotion. So some were here just because of the joy and beauty of nature, some because of conservation, some because of the implications for human health, some the implications of animal health, and some because of the joy of the progress of science, what's happened with communications in the digital age and genomics. It's at a point that it could be harnessed. The genomics keep surprising us. We've known for a long time about bacteria incorporated into humans, but now we're finding out that T. cruzi, a parasite, DNA, is actually incorporated into the DNA of humans and animals. And we don't even understand the importance of this, what it means. Some concepts today also got my attention, one of them being the Polybius, the world must be seen as an organic whole. But one was, as you look at the Manhattan Principles, Steve has used that wonderful word, consilience. E.O. Wilson defines that word as meaning, quotes, the jumping together of knowledge. I just like that visual image of knowledge jumping together. And that's what we were trying to do today, the jumping together of knowledge. Another concept, I advise students to attempt to simultaneously be generalists and specialists. Generalists to see as much of the world as they can see, and as specialists to know how their talents actually apply to that. How does this fit into the whole? Pelligan, a professor at Yale, has said the difference between good scholarship and great scholarship is that good scholarship can often be traced to your mentors, the place where you actually did your studies, but he said great scholarship can be traced to how much a person knows outside their specialty. And that's what we were looking at today, is how could we get the value of the generalist who's absolutely convinced that everything affects everything and the value of a specialist in one person. And finally, the last concept I'll mention is keeping a healthy dose of uncertainty. Certainty is the Achilles heel of both religion and science. And Richard Feynman gave an entire lecture once on science is based on uncertainty, always trying to prove that what you believe is not true. And I remember a book by Norman MacLean, the last one he wrote after A River Runs Through It, is about young men and fire. And he talks about the expert on forest fires going to the place where the forest fire was and finding out that his theory of forest fires that he'd held all his life and taught was not true. And he saw that in one day, and he was filled with joy. He didn't know it was going to be the last day of his life. He happened to die that night of a heart attack. But filled with joy, and he didn't die of a heart attack because he found truth, but filled with joy that he was able to prove himself wrong. And that's the kind of uncertainty we have to bring to this, always willing to learn from new information. Now, some of the approaches to consider. One of the pioneers in this area I regard as Jim Steele. Jim Steele was a veterinarian who worked at CDC. And last year, I went to Houston, Texas, to speak for his 90th birthday. For some years, they've had a speech on his birthday, an annual speech, and for some years, he's been asking me if I would come for his 90th. When I got there, I realized his big fear was that I wouldn't make it to his 90th. But I started the talk, and with a personal experience of his, the interface between human and animal health in his own life. He became very ill at one point, and Russ Alexander had an office across from him. Jim Steele is a big guy, and Russ Alexander said he became weak as a kitten. And no one could come up with a diagnosis, and CDC did every test they could, and then sent his serum off to Plum Island. Plum Island, not knowing this was a specimen from a person, assuming it was from an animal, cabled back and said that they had diagnosed foul plague, and they advised that CDC should immediately euthanize the animal. Well, he's a big guy, and no one had the courage to actually do that. And because of that, Jim Steele continued to make contributions in the traditional things, rabies and brucellosis, toxoplasmosis, but in the new things also. Whether it was loss of fever or mad cow, monkeypox, avian influenza, he was always interested. For the last 30 years, there has been, on average, a new disease every year. And Jim Steele points out that most of those are involved with both animals and humans. He used to promote the idea of WHO doing inclusive surveillance for both animal and human diseases, looking for the earliest clues, as we heard today, getting ahead of the curve. One of my first jobs in the 60s was to work in the relief action in Nigeria during the Nigerian-Biafran Civil War. And at that time, I read a fair amount about famine. And famine, up until the late 1940s, simply was not in the consciousness of people. Even when the great famine of Bengal in the mid-40s occurred, the British living in India did not see it as their responsibility. You see how social norms have changed. Nowadays, CNN simply puts a picture of a starving child, and there is a response. And the response is getting better and better. It used to be that you had to have starving people before you had a response. Now there are all kinds of surveillance systems around the world that track food prices and find scarcities even before anyone is aware of them because of food prices. And then they can predict when there will be a famine. So the only time we really have famines today are when the political situation does not allow the world to respond to that. Jim used to also talk about understanding life cycles and what that means. Now, some of you took biology courses, and you'll remember you had to learn a phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And none of us knew what it meant, but we knew how to spell the words, and we could get by on the test. But if you've never taken a biology course, what it says, in essence, is every individual, the development of that individual recapitulates the whole history of the ancestors before them. It's a nice concept. Well, I was thinking today, the history of the human race is expressed in that child in the Midwest who developed a rash. But the history of monkeypox virus is expressed in the organism that caused that rash. You see how complex it starts becoming. The history of the giant Gambian rat is expressed in the animal that brought that virus from Africa to the Midwest of the United States. And the history of prairie dogs is incorporated in the transmission from the Gambian rat to that child. And the history of vaccinia virus is incorporated in the vaccine that prevented additional cases. And the concept of ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny also has social implications, so that there's a social and scientific history of the human race that produced the vaccine that prevented those cases. And it reminded me of the New Yorker cartoon many years ago where the man says, "I predict a great future for complexity." And I thought of that complexity today and went back to something very basic. In chemistry, you may recall, if you put two things together, and it becomes a mixture, that mixture retains all of the characteristic of each ingredient. But if you get a compound, you now have new characteristics not found in the components. So sodium is one thing, chloride is another thing, but salt is totally different. But salt in water is a mixture. Well, if One World, One Health is to get traction, it must also become a compound, not just a mixture, with new characteristics where both humans and animals are seen as both vectors and victims and intertwined in a way that you cannot pull them apart. And I was thinking about Albert Schweitzer when he came up with his philosophy of reverence for life. He developed that philosophy because he said ethics was not capable of looking at the current world situation. Ethics, he said, is person-centric. It revolves around people. And he said ethics needs to take into consideration animals and plants and the environment and everything. And he developed that philosophy of reverence for life. And that's what we were hearing about today. We also saw today how the power of the computer can sort and capture and even present material. And so it led me to think we need the global equivalent of a CAT scan. Now, CAT scans use the computer to put together a series of x-rays into an image that we can all see, and in a way a human can't. When I was going to school, they did tomograms. They did one x-ray after another, and you looked at each one. CAT scans can put everything together. We need the global equivalent of a CAT scan, slices of everything interpreted by powerful computer programs that go beyond what we can do as individuals. And I think bioterrorism and emerging infections are the twin engines that we should use in how we develop this field of One Health, because both require similar approaches. The best information you can get, as we heard today, knowledge is power. The best interpretation of that information. Routines that are practiced in order to respond to every contingency that we can think of, and then a protocol for the things we didn't think of, for the unexpected problems. Then we need responses that are global and not just national or state responses, with an evaluation built into the response. Could we muddle through? Well, those of you familiar with Atlanta, there's a place called Toco Hills near Emory University. And I used to go there for haircuts. And at this shop, you could either call ahead to get an appointment with a certain barber, or you could just show up and you took your chance with whoever was there. Well, there was something about, why would I spend all that time choosing a barber but go to the airport and take the next pilot in rotation? I mean, it just didn't seem right. And so I used to go with no appointment. And one day, I got a young woman who was still in her training, but she was very eager to please. And she asked me, do you use mousse in your hair? Now, I'm embarrassed to say that was so long ago, I didn't know what mousse was. I mean, I thought it was food, and I couldn't understand her question. And she had to explain it to me. Then she asked whether I used hairspray, and I didn't. And then she asked me, do you use a hair blower? And I said, well, my hair dries on the way to work. And then I asked, should I be doing those things? And she quickly said, oh, no, unless you want your hair to look better. So could we muddle through? Sure, unless we want the world to look better. Could it look better without deliberate and concerted action? It's not a chance. There's a tension as the science expands, we understand more of the details, but as the science expands, it becomes more difficult to master. And we return to this concept, we have to try to be generalists and specialists simultaneously. One example of specifics that we heard about today had to do with bushmeat. And last month in The New Scientist, there was a report on bushmeat, and I found it very interesting that there's actually a bushmeat crisis task force. There are a lot of things happening in the world that even if you're a generalist, you have no idea that this is going on. But they estimate that in the Congo Basin alone, between 1 and 5 million metric tons of bushmeat was consumed last year. Think of that. And the dangers of eating SIV-infected animals are real. The task force points out that the SIV infection, the animal equivalent of HIV, has now been reported in 26 different species of African non-human primates, many of which are hunted and sold as food. And the fact is, we could highlight a story like that every week of something where animal health impacts on human health. Stephen Hawking once said that the whole history of science is the gradual realization that things do not happen in an arbitrary fashion, that this is a cause and effect world, and that slowly we're getting the pieces to understand that world. But how could we go from the rhetoric of today to a plan? Well, I like to start with an article, editorial, that Norman Cousins wrote in 1975. And he was writing about the bicentennial and asking the question, what's the greatest gift the United States has given the world in 200 years? And its answer is, the greatest gift that the United States has given the world is the idea that it's possible to plan a rational future. And he says the Constitution turns out to be the incarnation of that idea. Now, we don't always carry through with this idea of a rational future, but it is something over 200 plus years that we have done a reasonably good job at. But let's be clear, it's far easier to get agreement with the people who are in the room today than it is to plan a rational future for One Health. This meeting is one step, and a plan is going to require a coalition. Many people are wary of coalitions and say that they're a waste of time. I have been very impressed with coalitions. One that I'm particularly impressed with is when the Merck drug company decided to give away a drug called Mectizan for river blindness. They had developed the drug from a soil specimen taken in Japan. And it's a Polybius story in itself. I mean, think of this, a soil specimen taken from a golf course in Japan, worked on in a lab in the United States by a scientist from the subcontinent, Mohammed Aziz, to develop a drug to prevent heartworm in dogs. And then Mohammed Aziz began asking, would this have any human applications? And he went to Roy Vagelos, who was at that time head of research for Merck, and they concluded that they would not be able to make money on this drug, and Roy Vagelos put up the money anyway. And he went to Africa and found that this drug, which was a miracle drug for dogs, because before this drug, you had to give your dog something every day for a heartworm. With this drug, you had to give it once a month. And so some of you are familiar with, you get this red heart that you put on your calendar, and that's the day you give your drug. So a miracle drug. It turned out to be more of a miracle drug in humans, because a dose once a year could kill the microfilaria of onchocerciasis and keep the person free for 6 to 9 to 12 months. So once a year, if you gave that drug, you could prevent blindness due to onchocerciasis. Merck decided to give the drug away. They first went to WHO, and they became so upset with the bureaucracy that they walked away from that. They went to USAID, same offer, we'll give you the drug free if you'll figure out how to distribute it. And USAID said they weren't interested. And so finally they came to Atlanta and asked, would we come up with a plan to distribute this? For 12 years, I chaired the Mectizan Expert Committee for Merck, and they've now given away 300 million treatments for humans. And when you look at the coalition that has developed, there is no structure. I mean, this coalition doesn't answer to WHO or UNICEF or the World Bank or Merck. It's made up of people from dozens of ministries of health, literally hundreds of NGOs and medical mission groups. It includes WHO and UNICEF and World Bank, UNDP, foundations. And then you think about it's financially subsidized by the Dogs of America in Europe, who are getting the heartworm drug, and how this is a Polybia story, that everything affects everything. And it's a coalition that the closest it comes to a structure is that people have to apply to the expert committee and show how they will use the drug. They have to convince them that they will not let this get into the veterinary market, and they have to convince them that they will give the right dose to the people depending on their size. There are two essentials with this kind of coalition. There has to be some leadership that someone will follow, and then there has to be a shared goal. And that's the essence of Gary Will's book called Certain Trumpets. He takes the title of the book, Certain Trumpets, from a Bible verse that says, if you hear an uncertain trumpet, who would gird for battle? And so he says leaders have to sound certain trumpets that cause people to gird for battle. So he said the way you become a leader is very simple. You come up with a shared goal, and suddenly you have followers, and you're the leader. So it has to be leadership and a shared goal. Will Durant, looking at the United States population in 1941, was intrigued by how, after Pearl Harbor, people lost their differences and they were willing to work together. And he asked the question, what would it take to get a global coalition? And he came to the conclusion it would require an alien invasion. Nothing short of an alien invasion would actually cause a global coalition. But now we see that there are some surrogates for an alien invasion. Nuclear weapons has turned out to be one. We can all see this as a threat, and people have been willing to sit down and to talk about it. Smaller examples have included smallpox, now polio, and perhaps we're reaching that point with AIDS. But the question is, could One Health become a surrogate for an alien invasion if we work at it? And the point that Will Durant makes is how difficult it is to do that. People actually have to worry enough in order to get that kind of coalition, but I think there's a story here that could make people worry. Every environmental problem that we worry about ultimately has an impact on human health. The ozone layer, deforestation, acid rain, air quality, they all impinge on human health. And yet the public health community has such immediate problems to worry about, it hasn't engaged fully in that. Illiteracy is a human health problem, but the public health community has not fully engaged. Poverty is certainly a human health problem, and we know that it's dose-related. The more poverty, the worse your health. And yet, public health hasn't totally engaged. And likewise, we've often marginalized animal health. So the first job is to make this problem understandable, real, and absolutely needing a solution. It's not just that it would be nice to do this, we need to do this. Churchill once said, play for more than you can afford to lose and you will learn the rules of the game. It's far more than we can afford to lose. We heard today we're all in this together. We heard great things from what WHO is doing, FAO, CDC, and so forth. But the thing that struck me was how much effort it took for each disease, and we only looked at three of them. And that even when you started probing with those three, there were many things undone. So how in the world do you approach dozens and hundreds of conditions? It seems to me one of the next steps in a practical approach is to get this on the agenda of the World Health Organization, not just as another problem, but as a priority, and use that as a leadership base to get an effective coalition. That would allow WHO to get this in turn on the agenda of Kofi Annan, which they've done now for three health conditions, and it's paid off. They've done this for AIDS, they've done it for polio eradication, and recently they did it for highway safety, the injuries being caused in the developing world on highways. In this way, the appropriate resources, interest, and concern could be garnered. Then the group that assembled today has to be prepared to indicate how current global surveillance systems should be augmented. What's the inventory? What do we now have? How could reporting best be done? Could that reporting be automated? How will analysis be done? How will transparency be assured? What kind of responses will be developed for global and national levels? How do you encourage participation of all necessary parties and still avoid bureaucracy and political interference? How do you link so that you don't have to go to different funding sources to see this as a unity? We often say in immunization that vaccines unused are of no use at all. The whole science is wasted. And if you go through the process of getting a vaccine out to a child in Africa and it hasn't been properly refrigerated, you've just wasted everything. Well, the knowledge we heard about today, if unused, is of no use. I like to tell the story of James Thurber going to a party, and a woman confronted him and said that she was an American, but she was now living in Paris, and that in Paris, they were putting his articles in the Paris newspapers in French. And she said, I think they're even funnier in French. And James Thurber said, yes, they tend to lose something in the original. But this knowledge that was presented today loses something in the original. If it's not translated into action, it is lost. So it's important to spell out what the equivalent of a global CAT scan means. How are the parts collected? And how is the computer program developed that relates this in a way that humans could never see to what the real situation is, so that the relationships are clear, the actions are logical, the evaluation of the impact is continuous and in real time. And we're apparently better at doing this sort of thing with space probes than in global surveillance. There's an African proverb: knowledge comes from taking things apart, wisdom comes from putting them back together. We need both in this program. We have successes or partial successes to draw on. Smallpox eradication was promoted during the Cold War at a time when in the field we had Soviets who were supervising Americans and Americans supervising Soviets. And it worked because the shared goal was smallpox eradication. We have agreements on how the world will work in Antarctica and so forth. So we have some experience. And we have an opportunity now to unify human and animal public health work and make it state of the art. One of the assets and responsibilities of epidemiologists turns out to be that they actually can see the future. And that the people in this meeting today were looking through that window to the future. Do we have the talent and the tenacity to paint the picture so everyone can see that future? And then do we have the wisdom to use our knowledge? After everything we heard today in terms of the problems of global health, I can tell you we haven't seen anything yet. After everything we heard today about the solutions that science has brought, we haven't seen anything yet. As Harlan Cleveland has said, we are at a point in history where nature and nurture actually come together, allowing us to mastermind our own evolution. Jonas Salk used to say, evolution will be what we want it to be. And that's the challenge to the people here assembled. With all of the changes, the scientific changes, the communication changes, the ability of computers to do more and more sophisticated things, the improvement in our understanding, what do we want evolution to be? And how do we make today's meeting a step towards a rational conservation and health future? Well, I encourage WCS to take additional steps, because for the sake of those children who won't be born for 300 years, we can't just muddle through. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fagy. Bill advises me that he's willing to take a few questions if they're not hard. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask small parts, if I may. My name is Ian Weatherly. The genie, as it were, is back in the bottle, but certain stops of the virus are maintained. In the face of terrorism, we can do some dreadful things. Is there really a solid rationale for keeping that virus expanding?
Well, one of the reasons that the virus was kept, I think, is the mistaken idea from some of the people in the intelligence community that you need that virus to produce the vaccine, and you don't. The vaccine is made from vaccinia and not from smallpox virus. So people have been wanting to get rid of it. What we didn't know, of course, was all that time that we were trying to get rid of the two stockpiles, one in Russia and one in the United States, we didn't know that the Soviet Union had produced 200 tons of smallpox virus. And then, of course, the question is, who else has it? And so we don't know where that virus is. Nonetheless, it doesn't change your question. We don't need that virus to make the vaccine, and so we could do without. Now, what happened in the last year, last 2 years, was the concern that there might be an outbreak was one of these places where the intelligence community and the public health community did not quite get together, because the public health community did not know what the risk was, and the intelligence community would not tell them. Now we know, of course, that the intelligence community also didn't know. But, but a CIA memo came up with the conclusion that there was a 50-50 chance that Iraq might have weaponized smallpox. That became the basis of that entire program. Well, the U.S. solution to that was, as you recall, a three-phase program, and phase three would not take place until 2004, after the U.S. had intended to invade Iraq. So it didn't make sense from the beginning why we had that disparity. The next part of the question was, or the next part of the response from the intelligence community was published on the front page of the New York Times, that Iraq might have a strain of smallpox that they had gotten from the Soviet Union that was a modified strain not responsive to the vaccine, which caused some of us to ask, but why are we doing this then? If we can't stop this strain with this vaccine, why are we doing it? And so the program became one of asking the question, what sort of numbers do we have to vaccinate, rather than what is it we need to do to be responsive to a possible outbreak? So we've gotten lost in this, but we lost right from the beginning in the importance of keeping that virus, and now in how to respond to a possible outbreak. That was more than you asked for, I realize. Yes.
Could you comment on the genetic modification of not smallpox, but other kinds of viruses that have been conducted in some universities in the United States and in Australia, and what institutions that has for us?
Okay, the question is about genetic modification of pox viruses. And the fact is, we're getting into a whole new area now that we don't know the implications of. Back when we were talking about what to do with smallpox virus, my thought was that both the Soviet Union and the United States, and then Russia and the United States, should give all of our stocks to WHO, and this should be under some sort of international body. And they would come to the agreement on what kind of protocols should be used in doing research studies. And then that should be done with great transparency. I have a similar feeling with this modification of organisms when we don't know what it might lead to, that it's very difficult to do this with a single institution making a decision on what are the implications. And that we would be well advised to have some sort of international group. that decides on both the science, the ethics, the social implications, the equivalent of an environmental impact statement, a social impact statement. Yes, Marguerite? There's nothing more powerful with WHO than to get a resolution passed at the World Health Assembly. And I know that because in March of 1984, I was told that WHO would not do polio eradication. They had too much other work to do and that they would drag their feet and prevent that from happening. Well, a group of scientists got together in March of 1984 and looked at what are the scientific possibilities of this. And that same group of scientists and ministers of health, 2 months later, went to the World Health Assembly, passed a resolution calling for polio eradication, and immediately WHO then began to take the lead in it. So that is their board of directors. And getting a resolution at the World Health Assembly is the way to get something done in One Health. Yes. Am I right that that's the way to get WHO to do something? The answer is, of course, but I think it should be the group that put together this meeting that takes the lead on it. And one other thing, our own Congress in this country often has unfunded mandates, that it comes in and tells the states you have to do this, but they're not necessarily resources going with it. So whoever goes to the World Health Assembly should, in addition, be trying to figure out where the resources could come from, so that you're saying to WHO, it's very important to do this, and we will help you find the resources. I mean, it's just amazing how strapped WHO is, and how we expect them to look at disease problems around the world on a budget less than some hospitals have in this country. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So to come up with resources and the resolution would be the way to do this.
Well, thank you once again, Bill, for a terrific talk and your continuing inspiration. Let me close the program by saying that there is a saying in Brazil that is, Santo de casa não faz milagre, which means that the little saint that you have in your house doesn't really make miracles. And we know that at WCS, that the little saints or the little effigies that we have around are not enough. And so we brought you all together because the power of your presence here today and this evening will make us stronger, and maybe we will achieve the miracle that we need to for a one health world. Thank you so much for coming and for your attention this evening.